This is the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group, supporting Jewish communities worldwide. I'm Jack Mendel, and in this week's show, we're going to talk about the issue of racism in sport. This comes after West Ham fans were filmed chanting anti-Semitic songs at a Jewish man on a plane, and a Chelsea fan was convicted for sharing anti-Semitic social media posts. This also comes after Jewish News Yorkshire expose with former captain and current coach sharing the Y word on social media. Joining us this week is writer and lifelong Chelsea fan Ivor Badil, Dan Levine, who wrote about the club for 17 years as a journalist, head of special projects at Chelsea, Rola Brentlin, and Rabbi Alex Goldberg, who chairs the English Football Association's Faith Network. I'd like to start by asking Ivor how anti-Semitism in the stands has changed over the many years he's been a fan of the club.
Well, you know, this is a bit sort of blowing my, and to an extent my brother's own trumpet, but we first made a short film with an organisation called Kick It Out, who have done a lot to try and combat discrimination and racism in football. We first made a film with them about the Y word, I think getting on for 12, 15 years ago. And at the time, it was that issue had never really been raised. As I say, Kick It Out and other organisations had done an awful lot to try and combat discrimination and racism, but no one had really addressed this issue. So we made this film, which was very much, at the time, a starting point, trying to get people to just talk about the issue and raise the issue and create awareness. And I you know, sounds a bit immodest, but I think we did that. At one point, I believe even David Cameron commented on it, so it reached that level. So I think we certainly raised the issue. And then, my chronology is not very good, but Rola possibly knows better, but about 4 years ago, I think, Chelsea, I think in conjunction possibly with Kick It Out, asked me to make another film on the same topic, which kind of moved the debate on a bit. I think by this time, everybody was well aware of it. And this one was far more hard-hitting. In fact, it was around the last World Cup and involved, I may be wrong, but I think they were West Ham fans as well, chanting, well, a horrendous chant starts with Spurs are on their way to Auschwitz. And that particular film was far more hard-hitting, whereby trying to show people, they might think these chants, unbelievably, this is to, you know, the level of confusion with that, but they might just think these chants are anti-Tottenham. As I was trying to show them, when you're singing this sort of thing, this is what it means, well, to everybody, but particularly to Jewish people. So in that film, we cut in scenes from Auschwitz to show people exactly the effect, what the effect that these films were having. Anyway, sorry, I'm going on a long time. But in answer to your question, I do think that with those films and other initiatives, Chelsea in particular have been very good. Their Say No to Anti-Semitism campaign is fantastic. I think there has been an effect, and in terms of certainly the Y word chanting, as far as I'm concerned, seems to be slightly less amongst, certainly amongst Chelsea, Arsenal, to an extent West Ham fans, and maybe not quite the same at Tottenham. They maybe have a bit more to address. But I think, if anything, it has gone down a bit since we first made the film.
Rola, as somebody who's been at the forefront of driving Chelsea's campaign to eradicate anti-Semitism, do you think it's disappeared from the stands, or do you think it's moved elsewhere, maybe online? And if so, how can you tackle that problem?
Well, I think there's two ways of looking at it. One is incidents, right? And I mean, we still see incidents much more online, also because we're tracking it. But I think another way to look at it is also how many more fans are engaged on the positive end of things, right? So you kind of have to look at both. But if we started with the negative, I think incidents have become less. I think we need more years to really kind of, at least in the stadium, to see how it has changed. I know now during the last two games against Spurs, we've had actually no reports. And this is despite the fact that I think we're trying to encourage people to report a lot more. And we have a fairly easy reporting system, which makes a difference, because if you're in a stadium and it's not easy to report and you don't know how to do it and you're not constantly reminded to do it, of course your statistics will look better, but it doesn't really potentially reflect what's going on in the stadium. So I think it's been important to us to try to, you know, develop different merch and the match day program and all around the stadium, constantly reminding people, if you see something, report it. If you see something, report it, because that's the only way we can actually act, right? If we know what's going on. So we've had two games where there's been nothing, which is positive. Now, can two games, you know, that doesn't say, I think, more than those two games, but hopefully it's at least a positive development. Online is very tricky. I mean, for us online, it's not only anti-Semitic abuse, it's also racist abuse against our players. And if you would see some of the data we now have, it is absolutely horrific what is happening on the channels. So 6 months ago, we took a slightly different approach. We brought in CRISP, an external agency, who are basically now monitoring all of our channels to look for any abuse, whether it's racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, whatever it might be. And depending on the platform, then we have different capabilities to either delete or, in the case of Twitter, where we can't, at least mass report to Twitter. So I think we removed around 12,000 hateful comments since we started this a few months back. But it's definitely given us a better understanding of the scope. I will say not all of these are Chelsea fans. I think that's important to remember. So during, for example, the discussions around European Super League, we had a massive, massive just rise of anti-Semitic attacks on the owner. I think not a lot of that came from fans. It was definitely not season ticket holders, but just people, you know, because the platforms are big and the hashtags are very well used, you get an influx of all sorts of people in there. I think with CRISP, the positive is that we now better understand the scope. It gives us a little bit of an indication also how large it is in sports as such, because remember that social media platforms do not provide this data. So this is the only way we can actually try to see what it is. It gives us better capabilities to report. We're also, every incident we see now, we have another agency trying to find the identity of that person so we can provide that information to law enforcement if needed, or at least run it through our own databases to make sure they're not members or season ticket holders. Now, this is, you know, a quite comprehensive new way of addressing online. Can everyone do it? No, it's really expensive. So in our case, like all of this campaign, it's funded by Mr. Abramovich, and hence we have that ability and, I guess, privilege to do more. I mean, but I think at some point, especially online, I mean, we play our little part, but it's so massive. It needs to take a different approach because what's going on there is just horrific.
If I could turn to Dan quickly. Last week, Jewish News covered a story about a guy called Nathan Blagg, who had been jailed for tweeting all sorts of horrendous things, including that Spurs were going to Auschwitz. And earlier in the year, another fan was banned by the club for 10 years for tweeting similarly awful things on social media. As a journalist who has been involved in at least one of these cases, how does it affect you personally to see this kind of relentless abuse online?
I mean, obviously it's not pleasant, not pleasant at all. And I count myself as someone who's got fairly broad shoulders, but I think the sheer weight of it that there's been over recent years has clearly been very, very difficult. And personally, as being somebody who's put my head above the parapet and talked quite a lot about anti-Semitic abuse in football, I've become a bit of a target for a lot of that. It's interesting what both Ivor and Rhoda have said about the changing face of anti-Semitism in football and the way a lot of it has shifted in recent years from being, certainly when I first started watching Chelsea, very, very prominent in the stadium at home games, to something that now, you know, goes through other channels, and social media is clearly a key big battleground for that, if you like. But I think for anyone who is Jewish and has that as part of their identity online, I think it's something that, unfortunately, you become very used to. Whether you're a parliamentarian or a journalist, or presumably if you're involved in owning a football club or a rabbi. So it's difficult to know how that sort of thing can be controlled.
If I could ask Rabbi Alex, you work with a lot of football clubs and with the FA. You try and engage them and educate about the Jewish faith and other faiths as well. How much do you think it's about changing the culture at clubs so they become more welcoming and tolerant places for Jewish people or any minority for that matter? And how much do you think it's about going after the people?
I think it's a multilateral approach. First of all, the clubs need to recognise there is a problem of anti-Semitism. Chelsea have, and Rola's programme is absolutely fantastic. But it took years of work to get Chelsea to put in a programme like that, with people like Ivor doing the videos that he did, and his brother. the Y word. At the same time, John Mann and the FA were putting up a commission on anti-Semitism and Islamophobia. And what we noticed were two things. One was a denial of the problem at the highest level. When we were meeting at Downing Street in David Cameron's time, the Premier League denied, and I repeat, denied there was any anti-Semitism or any anti-Semitic chanting in any of their teams and any of their grounds. We're talking about roughly 2011, 2012. Today, the Premier League would not say that. Chelsea FC do not say that. And I don't know any teams in the top flight that would say there is not a challenge. Many have signed the IHRA definition on anti-Semitism and signed up to that, and others are putting in programmes. There are three strategies here, really. There's one is combating the anti-Semitism at source. As Roland has already mentioned, online anti-Semitism is growing, especially on fans forums and also Facebook, Twitter platforms run and owned by the clubs themselves. So there have been several clubs that have wished their Jewish fans a happy Hanukkah. It's something that they like to do. Happy Hanukkah, happy Diwali, happy Christmas, happy Kwanzaa, whatever it is. But it's a very nice thing to do. Under the line, under the bottom line, so-called fans, and again, we don't know if they are fans of that club or not, have then gone on to attack Jews, have attacked the state of Israel, and put some very vile anti-Semitic comments that people who are on social media today are only too used to. Not once, but hundreds of times and hundreds of people. Those clubs are looking into how to combat that. Do they stop putting out messages of good wishes to Jewish fans during those festivals? I think that's a backward step. That's surrendering to anti-Semitism. Or do they do what Roller's done, brought in a professional company who understands how to combat online hatred? And I think it is a professional job needed by professional companies. The second tier is reaching out to the fan base. When I was at Downing Street again in the same meeting, I said, if the people inside the stadium do not look like the people that live around the stadium, then your club has a bad business model and is not engaging with diversity in the big metropolitan centres. Most of our big top-tier teams come from very multi-ethnic, multi-religious areas of the country, whether it's Liverpool, Manchester, Leeds, London, or Birmingham, and that covers quite a few of the clubs. And some of them are more homogenous, but still have a growing diverse community. So reaching out to those communities, engaging with them in football is important. Why is it important? Because in this country, on the grassroots, in the parks today, we have less and less 11-a-side teams playing. And that means that we have a smaller and smaller pool of talent to recruit from for those big clubs. And that affects, for the FA in particular, the pool they can eventually recruit for Team England. So whilst we go on about winning a World Cup and we almost, well, a penalty kick or two away from winning a European Championship, it's going to take, again, getting young people out there playing the beautiful game. The third thing I would say is anti-Semitism. When you're dealing with racism and anti-Semitism, I would also like to promote the idea of positive Jewish culture. Increasingly, I've worked with clubs. We did the big iftar at Wembley Stadium. I've done sukkah in the stadium at Wembley and at Brentford. I told somebody on this call before we came on that I've been talking to the mascot of Watford. He's very upset because he can't go to a Hanukkah party on Monday because he'll be wet. Actually, Arola played Chelsea the day before. I think it's Harry the Hornet, I think, is the Watford mascot. Don't quote me on that. But Harry the Hornet's very upset that it would be a Monday night because his outfit will be wet because he's going to get sprayed, apparently, or it may rain when they're playing Chelsea at Vicarage Road. So could we put it on the Thursday night so he can come and join in with the donuts? I think that's really great. I think that's brilliant. And that club's also got a Jewish supporters group now, which is about to be launched. Brentford, likewise, are doing, which have a community stadium, want to reach out to the community. They're obviously a new Premier League side that have not been in top flight since the 1950s. And they want to grow their fan base. Chelsea, I know, have reached out to various communities and also Tottenham and Arsenal. So some of the London clubs are slowly doing that. But I would like to see more positivity about Jewish life, Jewish culture celebrated in clubs. The reason we did sukkah in the stadium in Wembley, just briefly, Jack, is because Wembley is considered a national stadium, the home of football. And for many people who don't go to synagogues, churches, mosques on a weekly basis any longer, the place that they think is a big edifice which they go and shout and pray and whatever is in their football ground. So the idea that the home of England is also home to a vulnerable little sucker is really important. And I hope other clubs take up the sort of sucker in the stadium Hanukkah parties, because that's a positive sign and a positive identity. In the United States, this month in November is Jewish Heritage Month. So you will have people singing, you'll have cantors and Hazan singing in basketball tournaments the American National Anthem, as they do at the beginning of every game. And that's a little bit quirky, a little bit American. We wouldn't do it here. But that sort of thing, some visible presence of Jewish culture and Jewish life alongside big Christmas trees and iftars in the stadium and things like that, I think is a part of the fabric of our communities. We are a complex country, a complex society, multi-religious, multi-ethnic, and all that should be celebrated.
To pick up on something you said, Rabbi Alex, so most Premier League clubs, although they have a local fan base, they're also kind of international brands. They have fans all over the world, and they therefore need to balance and reflect the local community and also their kind of global audience. So how do you educate a fan base which is so different? You know, when you have a local community which might understand, for example, the contours around the Y word debate, but that might not be understood in Indonesia or Russia or Brazil or whatever.
Sadly, I think anti-Semitism, because that's what we're talking about, is international. And what I liked about Ivor and David's original video, I have seen the second video too, and it is hard-hitting, was the fact that it was the first time that recognisable players were trying to explain anti-Semitism, explain the Y word, explain how it got into football culture, and state categorically, including the Chelsea captain at the time, categorically that it was unacceptable. Anti-Semitism, I think, is a global brand, Jack, I'm afraid, and has to be challenged globally. Clubs today have a choice of what they want their product to be. And there are plenty of toxic brands out there in the marketplace. You can see how brands become toxified overnight. The social media companies themselves are dealing with that. The toxic impact of racism online, anti-Semitism online, Islamophobia online. And they have to make boardroom decisions today about how they deal with that. Do they defend it by bringing in former top politicians to defend their product and their brand in the public arena and within parliaments around the world? Or do they actually have a proactive method of challenging that online and within their policies? Football clubs are no different. And if it comes from the top, when a club captain or a club manager or a club owner or all three say that anti-Semitism is wrong and they have a problem with it, it impacts on the fans and it impacts on other people.
Yeah. Ivor?
Well, it's interesting you say it's got to come from the top. I completely agree, and there's no denying that in British football. No. What I was going to say, you made me think about Tottenham and, you know, how there's no doubt that the vast majority of anti-Semitic incidents, I know that the situation with Israel and Palestine has made it slightly different, but for traditionally, it's 95% whatever to do with Tottenham and the fact that they use the Y word to describe themselves. And, you know, I have to say, in terms of their leadership from the top on that issue, they kind of give a blanket statement that, of course, they're against anti-Semitism and whatever, but they don't acknowledge, that really acknowledge, as far as I'm concerned, their role in it. I have heard that they are, I mean, they did a big consultation about, I think it was 2 years ago. The results of that seem to be moving in the right direction. I think, I can't remember the figures, but certainly amongst the younger fans, they didn't like the word and they acknowledged that it was a racist word. And I have heard they may be making some sort of announcement in January. But I think you're right, it's got to come from the top, and particularly with Tottenham, you know, with the Tottenham issue, you know, the chairman has never really said anything, as far as I'm aware, publicly about it. I don't think they've dealt with it particularly well. And I think it causes a great confusion. I'm going to say something a little bit controversial now, but those West Ham fans on the plane, of course, what they did was terrible. But for want of creating an argument, I'm not sure it's actually, in their minds, anti-Semitic. That's how deep the confusion the Tottenham thing causes them. Because, you know, our first film was all about just even explaining to people what the Y word could be a racist word for Jews. They didn't even know. They didn't know that it, you know, they just thought it meant Tottenham fans. So that song they're singing, of course they're singing it to someone who's obviously Jewish. But in their minds, it's just, oh, Jew, Tottenham, yeah, oh, that's what we sing. And I think, I mean, yes, of course it is anti-Semitic, but I don't think it's overtly anti-Semitic in that way. It's very confused. And I think the way forward for fans like that is education, as we've sort of said. And I think there's a slight danger, this may be wrong, but I've got a gut feeling, a slight danger in just really coming down hard on them. Because I think the real people, whenever there's anti-Semitism or any form of racism, actually the real people you need to deal with are the people at the top, the Tommy Robinsons and people like that. Right? These guys on the plane, I don't know, but I doubt if they're paid up members of the National Front, British Movement, whatever it's called these days. But by banning them, it's possible that they get so angry that it might push them towards that. Whereas if you take the more education approach, ban them for a few games, a season, whatever, but show them, again, it's a bit immodest, but show them my film, show them the work that Chelsea have done, show them what, you know, sit them down and educate them, then that, I think, would be far more effective and hopefully not push them to join the British Movement or say whatever it's called. So I think that's the way to deal with them.
Yeah, I think those are all good points. And the value of education is extremely strong. And having Rola here, the education work that she and the foundation do is brilliant on that front. But there's also, I think, something else going on here. And it's something that's very widespread in society at the moment. And it's a sort of wanton toxicity that people, a certain sort of people, want to be obnoxious for the sake of being obnoxious. And, you know, whether it's for likes, whether it's for clicks, whether it's for bants, I don't know. But a lot of the stuff that I see seems to be driven by that, and that anti-Semitism just happens to be a very, very handy thing to pick up to use. And an awful lot of the stuff I see, particularly around Holocaust mocking and denial and stuff like that, coming from these groups of people, seems to be focused around that wanton toxicity. The problem, of course, with football is that it makes its environment in which it is very easy for it to spread. When you've got largely a group of, let's say, young white men, normally, often if they're away from home, they've had beers, they've had some other refreshments as well, maybe. And this just seems to be a go-to thing. And taking that toxicity out of the situation is probably more difficult than simple education, I think.
If I could just finish with another sport. In the past couple of weeks and months, there's been controversy surrounding Yorkshire County Cricket Club with allegations of racism and bullying. It's clearly not just a problem in football, but it's a problem in other sports and in society in general. So given that football clubs are often the place where thousands of people gather every week and they see their friends and, you know, it's often a centre of the community for people, how can clubs tackle this societal problem?
I think, Jack, they tackle it together. Again, Yorkshire's given, I think it's what Ivor was saying, Yorkshire's now given good leadership. It hadn't before, and we can go on about Yorkshire County Cricket Club so the cows go home, not just on your scoop this week, which was brilliant and well done for exposing anti-Semitism at the highest level. But it's also grabbing the bull by the horns. Ivor was talking about Tottenham. I could talk about Ajax of Amsterdam. Similar problem. Management there. Actually a Jewish chair, which is very unusual now for Ajax. Maybe in the 1930s, not unusual. They had that Jewish identity in the club. And the chair said, you know what, this is just too painful and it's causing too much anti-Semitism. I'm going to roll back on that. That's 10, 15 years ago. And maybe it lost a little bit of its Jewish identity, which is a bit sad in some ways. But did they eradicate anti-Semitism? Well, they've done a really good job there, yes. And I think that it's again about bringing the fans with you, educating the community. 10 years ago, most of the big football grounds had learning zones. It meant they brought schools in. They were really proud of these learning zones. Sometimes they got funded by local authorities and governments to have them. I want to bring back learning zones into the football area. Let's not have, virtue signalling. Let's teach about how communities interact together, how football is at the centre of the community, how we combat racism, how Black Lives Matter, how anti-Semitism and Islamophobia are unacceptable. Let's use those learning zones again, because those stadiums are very, very big places and they can certainly have a little room, as they do at Wembley. We use that to bring different faith schools together. For 4 or 5 years, we brought single faith schools together. They learnt about each other, they talked about football, they talked about their identity at football at a young age, and they talked about their religions And that was really important because that meant that at the centre of that community, there were young people who went to single faith schools discussing football, identity, and it becomes part of their badge and it becomes part of linked to the football mentality. I like the Brentford model, the communitarian model. I like what Watford's doing in having a Jewish supporters group. I like what Chelsea are doing in terms of combating decades of anti-Semitism there. And there are other ways of doing it. Each club has its own identity and its own flavour and needs to tackle that sort of element in different ways by positive education and tackling the negative. But we've got to take our
communities
with us.
If I could finish with Rola, how much do you think it's a top-down approach and how much do you think it's a bottom-up approach at clubs such as Chelsea?
I think you have to have both. Without the leadership of Roman, Bruce, the board, it wouldn't be possible to do something like this. However, without having first spoken to all the fan groups and getting them on board, it wouldn't be possible to do something like this. So it is a two-side approach. We obviously, you know, we need to react strongly against when there is an incident and call it out. Sometimes naming and shaming is called for and works. I absolutely also agree with Ivor that that's not always the case. And some people, you know, you shouldn't label people as racist or anti-Semites if they're not, because that's what you'll create by doing so. So when it is clearly driven by ignorance, stupidity, whatever it can be, I think people should get a chance to make amends. And what we've seen when we've done that through the kind of restorative justice program, you know, those people are absolutely mortified in the cases we've had of, you know, A, what they've done, B, that they were caught, C, that they have to sit in front of, you know, like the Holocaust Educational Trust and discuss their words, demeaning on the community. They come back and they behave very differently. They still get a punishment, and I think a punishment always needs to be part of it. But I think they do come back, the ones that take this seriously, very differently. And I think by doing so, it's also, you know, the easiest thing all of us can do is just to ban. It's really simple. You ban, it's not your problem anymore. You get it out of the statistics. But you're not really making an impact then. So I think, you know, putting a little bit more effort into each of those events is important. But then, I mean, what I just kind of lastly want to highlight, I know we see these incidents and they're really, I mean, it's horrible. My experience, and I do not come from, you know, a decade of being a football fan in any sense, you know, shape or form. I've been so impressed to see the positives coming out of our fan base. You know, when we brought a group to Auschwitz, or every time I see one of the bigger Chelsea podcasts or Twitter account write about these issues, either about a Chelsea campaign or a specific incident or an event they attended with Chelsea that has to do with this topic. I think that's a really big shift. You know, I mean, some of these accounts have tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of followers. And the fact that they're taking time and, you know, pausing whatever transfers, latest injury or game to discuss these topics, I think that's a great step. So I'm just always cautious of viewing, you know, the fan base as an issue, because it's mostly not. And you have so many potential ambassadors there who can speak worldwide about these topics, and they all connect to each other, right? And listen to each other no matter of country, background, religion, wherever they're from. So I think if clubs would follow our example, I think you can do this and the fans will be with you. You know, it's not controversial. It's not nothing bad will happen if you start engaging on these topics more publicly. I think that's my main learning.
And that's it for this edition of the Jewish News Podcast in association with Genesis Philanthropy Group. For its partners, GPG is working to support the growth of Jewish community life in the UK and worldwide. To find out more, visit www.gpg.org. All that's left for me to do is thank our guests, Ivor, Rola, Dan, and Rabbi Alex, our producer Adam Bradley for his work in post-production, Justin Cohen for producing this week's show, and you, dear listener, for tuning in. Please do subscribe in your podcast application. That way you'll hear any previous episodes or be informed when new episodes become available. And don't forget that for more information on any of the stories that we've featured, you can always go to jewishnews.co.uk. If you'd like to comment, then we'd love to hear from you too. Please email editorial@jewishnews.co.uk.